Welcome back to The Roundtable. I'm Ian Pickus. The band Little Feat might be little remembered among casual music fans today, but like many of its 60s and 70s brethren, the band has soldiered on through brief pop stardom, band deaths, and the disagreements that often derail rock groups forever. Little Feat was led by guitarist and singer Lowell George in its early years. But after George's 1979 death at age 34, has enjoyed a second life over the past 25 years under fellow founder Bill Payne. Little Feat is the subject of a new biography by Ben Fong-Torres, Willen, The Story of Little Feat, which is published by DiCapo. Ben Fong-Torres is a titan of music journalism. He began writing for Rolling Stone in its eighth issue and has written several books and hundreds of magazine articles, in addition to a busy career on the airwaves in San Francisco. Ben Fong-Torres, welcome to the Roundtable.
Hey, Ian. Good to be here.
What led you to write about Little Feat?
By the way, a very nice table you got here.
Thanks.
Well, it was a Little Feat fan, a well-placed one, I must say, named Ben Schaefer. He is an editor at DiCapo Books. And when he got the word out that he would love to have a book about one of his favorite bands, the word got to my agent, Sarah Lazen, in New York, and she reached out to probably her stable of writers, and I was among them. And the idea just took me back in time, probably about 40 years, to when I was at Rolling Stone and also a DJ on our local FM rock station, when that was still a pioneering thing. And we loved Little Feat here in San Francisco on both levels. On the radio, we played them, and in print, we praised them. And so it also kind of took me back full circle to one of my first books called Hickory Wind, The Life and Times of Gram Parsons, who, like Lowell George, was under-recognized, overly talented, a creative genius, and never got their due on a commercial level. So I kind of liked that. And also, finally, Little Feat contrasted so much with their peers called the Eagles, and they were my last book subject, so I thought, wow, what a stark contrast in their stories, except for the constant fights among the band. So I thought this would be an interesting possible assignment. So after doing a bit of research and seeing what a large fan base they still have, and the whole grassroots movement, the website, and their use of technology to keep fans apprised of what's going on, I thought, yeah, this book might have some legs, if not feet. So I said, yeah, put my hat into the ring, and that's how it turned out.
Had you lost touch with where the band went in those 40 years?
Oh, I don't lose touch with too much, except my own faculties. And so, yeah, on occasion I would hear and read about the band, just because part of my radio coverage means tuning into radio here and there. And I would hear Little Feat still getting played on mostly non-profit, non-commercial stations.
Our kind of stuff.
On public stations, you know, college stations, you would hear regenerations of interest in the band. And just talking about music, you know, people would just bring them up as a favorite. And that was especially true when I got the assignment and started telling friends and associates that I was doing Little Feat, and they would just all melt and say, yeah, they were one of my favorite bands, which always led me to wonder, well, gee, if they were the favorite bands of so many people, why weren't they ever a commercial success, you know, the way they could have been?
So why weren't they?
Well, different folks have different responses to that question. Bonnie Raitt told me that she thought it was maybe just bad timing, and that they didn't have that kind of charisma that a lot of bands have. That others say that the songs were too quirky. Maybe they were too eclectic and too far out of the mainstream. And so you hear a lot of, then there are those who say, well, the record company didn't support them. But it's hard to say when a band doesn't make it. But it's also sometimes hard to say when a band makes it. You wonder, oh, why are those guys big chart toppers? They're equally anonymous. They're equally uncharismatic. Their songs are kind of out there, and yet they become explosively big. So a lot of it is just luck and timing. I think Little Feat did have support from their record company. They did have large fan bases in a number of communities, as Lena Ronstadt pointed out to me. She couldn't believe my theory about, you know, posing the question about why they weren't big. She thought they were because she saw them being adored and well-attended concerts in various cities when she was hanging out with Lowell George and the band. But by and large, I think it really comes down to timing and the fact that they just stood there and played. You know, they were not like the Stones running around dancing and stuff and reaching out to the audience and telling funny stories between songs. Although Lowell himself had a tremendous charisma and could talk between songs and all of that. But by and large, the band struck people as being pretty much just strictly business.
Lowell George was a really kind of preternatural talent, songwriter, singer, instrumentalist. How was the band able to survive his loss and a long period of inactivity to come back to the group it is today?
I think they survived his loss by a passage of time. They were already exquisitely good performers and musicians. They all knew, or many of them knew, how to write good songs. They had had all those years with Lowell, in most cases, and so they already were equipped. Then the passage of about 9 years between Lowell's death and their reunion for a little tribute to Little Feat at a rehearsal facility that was being dedicated to the band and to Lowell. By that time, they had all gone off to other bands, so when they came back together, they were ready. And they had been involved with Craig Fuller, or at least a couple of, Bill Payne for sure, had been involved with Craig Fuller already from the Pure Prairie League. And besides himself being an excellent musician and songwriter and vocalist, he happened to sing in the same range as Lowell George. And so when he tackled some of those songs, especially the more ballad, romantic tunes, he could sound quite a bit like Lowell without forcing it, without trying to fill anybody's shoes. And so that made it a pretty smooth reunion, and the result was that, ironically, their first album back, called Let It Roll, was by far their biggest seller of any of their studio albums. And so, yeah, when they reemerged and reentered the fray, they had their skills intact, and they still had their fans who remembered them and came flocking to them.
We're speaking with Ben Fong Torres. I want to ask you a little bit about yourself now that we've talked about Little Feat a bit here. You were at Rolling Stone in the very early days of the magazine, and I wonder if you still read Rolling Stone?
Yes, I do.
Where did you see that place going when you started there?
Well, you know, it's hard to say. When you're in the midst of a storm or a phenomenon or a big scene, you're not aware of anything but surviving and keeping things going or whatever, you know, continue to have fun, depending on what the situation is. We were really wrapped up in this ridiculous deadline that Jan Wenner imposed because he liked having a magazine out every 2 weeks. So we were doing twice as much work, I think, than the normal national monthly magazine. But it was a tremendously great challenge for us. It was a lot of fun to do that. And at that time, we were already drawing a lot of attention from the national media, which normally would be competitive and not pay attention to an upstart from San Francisco like Rolling Stone. And that gave us a sign that this was going to be something. What it was going to be, no one knew. We knew that Jan Wenner had entrepreneurial ambitions. He wanted to grow his world and create a mini empire, which he did. When he moved to New York, although it was kind of a shock, it wasn't really a surprise for those of us who knew about Jan's own goals for the magazine and for himself. And so that was about all I could think of, that it was growing, it continued to weather various competitive storms and changes in music and in the media business, And it did. That's to Jan's credit, that he and his team, whatever it was through the passage of years, was able not only to survive, but to actually thrive and still maintain the basis of what Rolling Stone was when it was born in late 1967 in San Francisco.
Now, I think a lot of people are familiar with you, if not from your writing alone, but also as being one of the characters in the film Almost Famous. You're kind of the laid-back but hectoring editor in that portrayal who's trying to get the story in from the road with the band Sweetwater. Is that true to your remembrances of that time, that film?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. But, you know, being used as a real-life character was an honor for me, and to be part of a really wonderful film by Cameron Crowe, who directed and wrote it, was a pleasure and gave me new cred among the kids. But the fact is that it was a film, and so Cameron needed to have somebody be like an antagonist, the bad guy. And so he created a storyline so that I would serve that role. But I didn't have that role with him in real life, nor was I the kind of, sort of out of it editor who got fooled by a kid on the phone into believing that he was worthy of a cover story for the first assignment.
This is Rolling Stone magazine.
We got a couple copies of your stories.
I think you should be writing for us.
We can only pay, let me see, $700. All right, $1,000.
And so that just wasn't it. We saw each other in person a couple of times before he sent his clips to me out of San Diego, which is true. And then we had a phone call, and I assigned him a story on Poco that ran probably about 500-600 words. I've never gone back and looked at it over the years, but he did a great job. And so he quickly grew into a writer who could write a cover story for us, and he did within a year. But it was not the first time out. There were no problems with the story. We never disbelieved him and took the word of a stoned rocker over our own reporter. And also I wasn't always just in the office on the phone hectoring him, but I was on the road pretty much alongside him, you know, that is on a different path covering different artists. I was, along with all the editors at Rolling Stone, a multitasker. We all wrote short and long pieces. We edited, some of us administered. I oversaw the music section and also then at Deadline, wrote the random notes. That's what I mean about it being a crazy time and not really knowing what you were doing because you were just doing it.
Which leads right to my next question. We're lucky every so often on this show to have, you know, a really major rock star on, Brian Wilson, and Stephen Stills calls in or something. What's your advice for interviewing rock stars, because you have pretty much interviewed everybody?
My advice for interviewing anybody, actually, not just rock stars, is to offer them a sign of respect by knowing something about them before you go in, so that it's not just a promotional thing of their latest album or film or tour or whatever, but you've studied up on them, and not just online. You know, Wikipedia is invaluable, certainly useful, but you want to confirm things through other research of your own. Don't just go by the press release. And so offer them that respect. And try to be conversational. Don't pose a whole lot of questions that they can answer yes or no to. Ask some why questions, or back up your yes and no's with how and why. And don't follow just a list of questions, but be open to picking up the thread of conversation left by whatever she or he has just told you. So listen carefully, as you have, by the way, Ian.
Oh, well, thank you. I wanted to go to one other place, which is, you've had such a long and kind of varied career. It's obvious that early in your life, rock meant something important to you. And Little Feat is kind of an example of the fact that our pop music is not really rock anymore these days. What do you think the future of rock is?
Rock, as with other forms of music, folk, country, and disco, for example. But still, beyond that, country, blues, jazz, it's all cyclical. And it comes around again, sometimes in a similar form as before, sometimes embellished by new talents with new voices and new visions and new ideas and new expressions. And so I think it will always be around. Music has long ago fractured and fashionalized so that there are followings for all these different mini genres of music. There's no longer one popular music except for pop, which you hear now on what today's version of Top 40 radio is, which is a combination of hip-hop, dance, and Top 40. But I think that, by and large, rock will survive. It doesn't have the support on radio as it used to, but rock fans always manage to find a way to hear their music. And now there are so many ways to get that music online and on satellite and just through the streaming services, independent radio stations, and the occasional daring rock station that pops up on the commercial spectrum. So it will always be around. It will always be slightly different. But, I believe that that's the way it's going to be. There will always be rock and roll. I think the thing was, as a kid, I was lucky enough to grow up with Top 40. And Top 40 embraced all kinds of music, and including comedy and even gospel. But definitely, I heard a lot of blues on Top 40 radio from Bobby Blue Bland and Ray Charles and B.B. King. I heard a lot of country on the Top 40 radio. And that's why I grew into the person I was, with an interest not only in rock and roll and pop, but a lot of the other strains of music. And that's one of the appeals of Little Feat and Grateful Dead and Fish and a number of other bands that show a more encyclopedic awareness of and love for the different strains of music that make up American music.
Who do you want to write about next?
Don't know. This book almost burned me out. It was just very difficult, and so I'm taking a break and just I have a job with Quello, a streaming service for high-definition concerts and music documentaries of all kinds. So I'm doing stuff for them. I write a radio column here in the Chronicle. I do the television broadcast of the Chinese New Year Parade every year. I have a radio show online at Boss Radio on Sunday afternoons. And so, and I do the occasional freelance piece for various magazines. I'm in the new book put out by the Grammy Foundation honoring the Grammy Hall of Fame. And I think I'm in a special edition put out by Rolling Stone as a tribute to Paul McCartney. So I am juggling stuff as ever. And so I'm not looking for another job at this point. I tend always to be kind of passive about books. Sarah, my agent, calls and says, "Hey, get to work. Here's some ideas." And then she'll shake me loose and I get back to work.
Well, we won't take up any more of your time. Ben Fong Torres is the author of Willin, The Story of Little Feat, which is out now from DiCapo and a titan of rock criticism and music writing. It's just been a pleasure to have you on the show, and I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much, Ian. It's been a pleasure. Now I'm going to go play Tighten Up by Archie Bell and the Drills.
And you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Everything will be out of sight. Come on and tighten it up. You can do it.